go ahead and get started. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming out here for the Hawaii community meeting that we're hosting with Department of Health. This is about the Mahala Phylogen study. So I know that it's really hard to read a very dense report and very scientific, so we've come out here to try to explain it to you. And with me today, we have a number of people, and first I'll introduce myself. My name is Janet Hashimoto. My home office is actually the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in San Francisco. I'm here on a one-year or maybe longer detail to the Hawaii Department of Health Clean Water Branch. And so with me today, we have a number of people from the Department of Health that's also working alongside the principal investigator that we brought out here on this particular study. So I'll introduce Alec Wong. He is our Clean Water Branch Chief. So he has a number of programs under him, including NPDES permitting, monitoring, and an off-point source polluter runoff program, and the enforcement program. So he covers a lot of things, especially Clean Water Act. Then Myron Honda. Myron is also with the Clean Water Branch, but he specifically is the monitoring section chief. So this kind of study is directly under him. And then we have Gary Winton, who most people should know. He is our field person right here on the island, who collected a number of samples for the study. And then I brought here with me Eric Kavinsky. He was kind enough to come out here in person from the Berkeley lab. He is one of the principal investigators for the study that the Department of Health contracted with specifically to conduct the study, along with his the principal investigator who is unable to join us here. His name is Gary Anderson. So we'll have a presentation directly from the scientists who helped us conduct the study. So. And the way we're going to run this is, if this is not like a public hearing, we're not here to collect testimony. We're mostly here to make the presentation and be able to engage with you, have some open discussion, but most importantly, address some of the questions that you might have. So after Eric does the presentation, we'll also try to address some of the concerns we've already heard and, have both Myron and Eric kind of do some explanation, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers and really engage with you, because this is not just the end of the study. We want to do further investigations as well, so I just want to let you know that we have additional plans after this. So without further ado, I think we'll have Eric start off with the presentation.
Or maybe one of the logistic is, I just want to make sure that we know we have a restroom on both ends of this building. Men's room, women's room, men's room, women's room. Function is on this end. So just in case you need to take a break or maybe you need to take some water, it's available on that end. And also, we pretty much reserve this room is from 4 to 6. I hope we get enough time to finish all this presentation and answer your questions. Thank you. Thank you for your coming anyway.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. It's great to be here, and I'm excited to tell you about, give you more information about our study. And it's nice to see a full room here. A lot of times when I give presentations or talk about my research, I'm begging for people to pay attention. So it's nice that people have actually read something that I've written and are interested in it. This is a really interesting and difficult topic that the water quality community is dealing with. And I think you've done some really great work here, and I want to tell you about it. So we were contracted by the Department of Health to do a source tracking study to try to figure out where the bacteria in Mahalepu are coming from. And a little bit about my background, I'm a microbial ecologist, and I specialize in using DNA-based tools to understand the diversity of microbes in the environment. And about 10 years ago, we started thinking about how we can use some of these new tools that were coming online to really start understanding in a lot more detail where these sources of bacteria are coming from that are affecting watersheds around the country. I mean, this is these types of problems are found just about anywhere that water quality is being monitored. And so we got some funding from the state of California to take some tools that have been developed in our lab and to adapt them to water quality monitoring and to test to see how well they work. And so we've done a number of projects with the state of California, and now we're working with US EPA. And so through that, we got connected with the Department of Health here in Hawaii. And that's how we started working on this. So the central question that we're addressing in this report is, where are the bacteria coming from? So as you all know, high bacteria are persistently found in Mahalepu, in the Waiapili Ditch. And the question is, why are they there? What is the source? And is it a source that is potentially harmful? And so let's start by talking about what is meant by high bacteria. There's a lot of different bacteria out there. The Department of Health tests for enterococci bacteria as a way of monitoring microbiological water quality, and this is the recommended way by US EPA to look for what's called indicator bacteria. So the enterococci is considered an indicator bacteria and is in the US EPA as a recommended water quality indicator. And it's assumed that when you see this bacteria, that fecal pathogens are present. So it's not used, the enterococci itself is not considered a pathogen, but it's considered a proxy for a bunch of other pathogens that might be found with it. And the reason that they've set it up this way is because there's a ton of different pathogens in something like sewage. A lot of them are viruses. The viruses tend to be what make you sick. And those are really difficult to monitor. And the sensitivity of the tests that are used to monitor them are often not adequate. And so this is what's used as essentially the standard at this point. Hawaii also uses a supplemental fecal tracer to look for fecal contamination. But the issue that we've come down to is that the tests tell you nothing about what the source of the bacteria is. And so if you're monitoring an area where, say, you're downstream from a wastewater treatment plant and it's got a leak, they do really well because the source is obvious. But when you're dealing with a situation where there aren't obvious sources, they're diffuse, we call them non-point sources of pollution, that's where it becomes difficult to really know where exactly these high bacteria, these enterococci, are coming from. And so a lot of research has been done over the last couple of decades by the scientific community looking at potential sources of enterococci, and they're found in human waste and livestock feces. So almost every warm-blooded animal carries these enterococci, and that's the reason why they're used. They're easy to measure, and you can measure them rapidly in the lab. But what kind of confounds everything is that they're also found in a lot of other naturally occurring sources. Soils, sediments, decaying vegetation will have these enterococci as well. And so when in a place like Mahalepu, where it's not completely obvious what the source is, I mean, now you've got a menu of potential sources. And it's known from some of these studies that background concentrations of these bacteria can exceed 1,000 cells per gram of soil. So a pinch of soil could have a bunch of these types of bacteria in it. And so the task here is to tease out the signal from the noise. What are these coming, or any of these coming from some kind of fecal source? Because that is what we want to know in order to determine, is this a harmful source? Or is this a source that could potentially contain pathogens that make people sick? And so what we do is we try to essentially do detective work and figure out who's in the stream. And so how we do that is we take advantage of the fact that all these animals have unique compositions of microorganisms in their guts. Essentially, you can tell apart different animals based on the diversity of bacteria that is in their poop. And how we do that is we have a DNA-based tool. It's a profiling tool. And it measures a million different types of DNA. This is called a microarray. And I'm not going to get into all the nitty-gritty about how it works, but essentially what we do is we extract DNA from the water sample that we're interested in. We prepare that DNA, we put it on this chip, and it looks for a gene that occurs in all bacteria, and it's a barcoding gene. And it's what microbiologists now use to tell one bacteria from another. And when we do that analysis, we can then see if there's a signature, if there's a fingerprint that we know is associated with one of these animals that could potentially be contaminating the water. And so you might have heard about microbiomes in the news. I mean, what we're doing is we're analyzing the microbiomes of fecal samples, the microbiomes of water samples. It's essentially a survey of all the diversity of what's there. That really gives us a very specific fingerprint of these potential sources. And that is a great way of looking for what is potentially in these samples. It can detect 60,000 different types of organisms with all this DNA that it detects. And when the DNA that sticks onto the chip, we image it, we know it's there, it's not there. And I'm just showing you some blown up images of what it looks like. And we have a whole bunch of a whole analysis pipeline. But then at the end of this, all tells us what's there. And then we use this information to tell us what's in our samples. So now getting into what we did here. We were concerned with what was going on in Mahalapu. And so this study primarily focused on the Mahalapu watershed and specifically along the Waipili Ditch. But we also did work in the adjacent watershed as well, because that was identified as a concern by the Department of Health, because there may be some subsurface, some groundwater connection between these two watersheds. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But you have one watershed, the Waikoma watershed, which includes Poipu and Kloa Town, which has more human sources in it, and on-site disposal systems such as cesspools, injection wells. And so that was identified as one potential source, as well as the animals and so forth that live in Mahalapu watershed. So for the report, 14 samples were, 14 locations were sampled in the Waipili Ditch. There were some occasions where those locations were dry. So we sampled at four different time points between 2016 and 2017. And the idea there was to get a range of different conditions that occur when there's differences in weather and differences in runoff. So we sampled during two dry periods and two wet periods, and where there was water at these 14 locations, they were sampled. We also sampled the Makawai Cave, I hope I pronounced that right. The idea there as well was to determine whether there was any kind of hydrological or connection where these waste could potentially be transported into this stream. And then we also sampled over on the Waikoma side, the Waikoma stream, at five locations. And then three groundwater seeps, which I'll talk a little bit more about. I'll just point to a pointer here. So these are the groundwater or the seep locations. These occur along the coastline. And this is where groundwater emerges from the surface along the coastline. And so that gives us a perspective on what could be coming up from groundwater, and then as well as the Waikoma stream here. And then I should say that this is the map of the Mahalepu. I know you can't really see it, but look at the report, you can get an idea of where the sample locations were. But we tried to go from, you know, up at the top of the drainage all the way down to the coastline. And then some other sampling that was done, we sampled sediments from the Waipili ditch, up and down the Waipili ditch in that watershed at eight locations one time in May of 2017. Six injection wells were sampled in the resort area of Waikomo, and that was done to see if we could, how well we could identify a human signal that would be found in those locations, kind of a validation of our ability to quantify that signal. And then we also had the Department of Health collect a whole bunch of fecal samples from various potential sources in the area, because we wanted to calibrate our test for Hawaii-specific sources. Considering how important water quality is here, there's a lot of research that, you know, most of the research on water quality is done on the mainland. And so we wanted some very specific data on potential sources here, make sure that we've tuned our tests over on the mainland. We want to make sure that it works well here too. So we used the local fecal sources to calibrate our test and make it even more sensitive. So here's the process of how samples were dealt with. The Department of Health collected the samples. They brought those samples back to their lab. And then each sample was split. So what the Department of Health does is they do indicator bacteria counts. These are the tests that you guys are all probably familiar with, the enterococci, and then the alternative tracer, which is Clostridium perfringens. These are the routine tests used to quantify bacteria levels. That same sample, was preserved, sent to us, and we got the DNA out of it and ran our test. So each sample was run in parallel like this. And now I want to discuss, just give you an overview of what we found. So 42 samples in total were collected from the Waipili ditch. These are the surface water samples. Out of those 42, 84% of those had levels of enterococci that are considered high. They exceed the threshold value that is set by the EPA of 130 cells, essentially, per 100 mil. So it's confirming that, yes, levels are high. Levels of these bacteria are high in the Waipili ditch. And then the alternative tracer, the Clostridium, was high, I think over 50, which is kind of considered a high number by Hawaii half the time. So the indicator bacteria are high. When we looked for the DNA signal, we saw very little in the way of fecal signal from the sources that we tested for. And the sources that we tested for were human, ruminants, which are cows and sheep, pig, because as you know, you've got a lot of pigs running around. And then we also looked for horse, chicken, and then avian wildlife. These were identified in advance as being very likely, potentially the most likely sources that you would have for fecal contamination in this watershed. We only found one sample that had ruminant contamination, one sample out of these 42 that had pig, and nothing with a strong human signal. And so I just want to walk you through this graph just to give you an idea of the flavor of what the data looked like. And there's lots and lots of these graphs in the report. And if you're really interested, you can study them. Most of them, I pulled out some of the more interesting ones here because these show you what we're looking for. And what this does is it compares those enterococci counts, the counts of the indicator bacteria, to the fecal DNA signal. And so we're looking for essentially two things here. We're looking for, one, a high fecal DNA signal. We know from tests that we've done in other studies and our calibration that in our tests, we run from a scale of 0 to 1. When we exceed a value of 0.2, we got a definitive hit for that particular organism that we're testing for. And you can see here, yeah, we've got, okay, I don't know what happened to my little circles, but we've got a pig hit here, a ruminant hit there. And the other thing that we're looking for is a positive relationship between the enterococci and the fecal DNA signal. So here, if you look at this scale, we're going from a value of 10 to 10,000 cells in the sample per 100 mil. And that threshold value that that EPA recommends is right here at 130. So again, all these samples would exceed that limit. But there's over an order of magnitude, over a tenfold difference between here and here. But if you have that span of an increase in the indicator bacteria, and that those indicator bacteria are coming from a fecal source, one of these fecal sources that we're looking at, then you need to see it. You're looking for a positive relationship. Okay, high, if you have this many enterococci, then you've got to see a strong fecal signal there. And in the studies that we've done where we know we have a positive fecal signal, I can tell you that when we're up in this range, our numbers are way up here if it's a true fecal signal. We're not even getting above our threshold except for these few samples here. So that's how we're coming to the conclusion that these enterococci are not primarily sourced from any of these fecal sources.
Yeah, but technical, how do you get signal? How do you?
Sure. Yeah. It's okay. So we've got for each one of our source types, there's about 1,000 different DNA markers, more or less, that we've got. So essentially, we're doing 1,000 different tests at once for one source type. And all that information together is used to give us a probability. It's essentially a probability that that's a rough description of it, but there's a model that is used. So we train the model with our known samples, with our fecal samples. And then that outputs this signal number, which, if you've got pure sewage, if you have an exact match to the sewage, this number will be 1. Or if it's an exact match to the pig samples that you trained it on, then it would be 1. But unless you're sampling pure sewage, for example, you don't expect that number to be 1 because it gets diluted out in the environment, right? So that as that source travels into the environment, it's getting diluted, it's getting degraded, and so that signal goes down, and eventually it gets to a point where it's in the background noise. And so what we do in the lab is we determine at what value, using controlled tests, do we lose the signal, where how dilute do you have to go, and we lose our signal well below the statistical threshold value that EPA sets. And I can, if you're interested, I can send you some academic papers about the details on that.
When you were setting up your profile, did anyone ever inform you about the 11-year biosolid dump site that is in Mahalapu Valley as far as for getting samples of the soil where the fecal material was disked in or the water table below it to get some groundwater samples to train a profile of that potential bacteria source?
Yeah, that's and that would be a human source, ultimately.
It would be. It would be a human source that's been in the environment for a while.
Right, right.
It would be there, but as I understand it from this study, there was no profile done of the human biosolid.
No, we did not profile that.
And so you can't rule out that source as a potential contaminant for the Wapili in that case, correct?
We can tell you that, okay, so that, as I understand it, that's been inactive for about five or six years at this point. So the
not yet, but it will be.
Okay.
It's, I mean, it went through December 31st, 2014. Mm-hmm. It's, so it's not yet 5 years inactive.
Well, so we test for what makes our test unique is we test for the most persistent types of fecal bacteria. So we focus in on two groups, one called the Clostridia and one called the Bacteroides. And so we know from studies we've done and from a lot of other literature that Clostridia, for example, they form what are called spores, and they're very persistent in the environment. And then we've done degradation studies that have shown, and we've done this with US EPA and some other groups, LA Bain, Stanford, and we've looked at the degradation of pathogens, of indicator bacteria, of our signal, and all sorts of other tests. And our tests last the long. We see the human signal longer than any pathogens that have been measured persist. So if there was any human signal still left in that dump site, we're going to see it.
If you set a profile.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is ultimately that's a source, right? A human derived source. It's a human derived source.
And so we're
looking at the most persistent bacteria that would be found in that source.
And then that's what my question was. Did you set up a profile of that potential source? Did you set up the equipment to profile?
No, we did not test for that source. But we do test for the bacteria that would be persistent if there was still a signal there. But it would be interesting to look at.
Did you ever suggest to the Department of Health that the groundwater or the soil in that area should be tested?
We sampled the stream sediments, but we did not sample around that particular source.
You never sampled the area where Aqua Engineers dumped sludge? Was that a sampling site?
No, it was not.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll continue on, and then I'll be definitely want to address more of your questions.
Thank you.
Okay, so anyway, these are the two samples that we found from pigs and ruminants. And just to put those on the map, this is where they were found. And then this is just this data in another form, showing you that these are the sites basically from top to bottom. And so you can see how these stand out. And I do want to point out that we had a couple of samples that did have what we would consider potentially weak human signal. So they're approaching our threshold value. They're not quite exceeding it. So we're not completely ruling out the presence of human contamination in the water. But there is no correlation between the Enterococcus concentrations and that signal. So the goal here was to determine whether or not the Enterococcus were correlated with the human fecal signal. And so we did not see that. So what we're trying to answer is whether or not the Enterococcus are derived from the human source. We're not 100% ruling out that there were any human sources present in the watershed. Looking at the sediments of the stream, we saw no indication that there was any of these sources. Nothing exceeded our threshold there. And then I want to go through the Waicomo watershed results. So again, this sampling was done with in mind thinking that there could potentially be transfer of fecal contaminants from this watershed via groundwater into the Malalepu watershed. This is, again, going through stream results like we did with Wapili stream. looking at our detection frequency of exceedances for the indicator bacteria, which had a very similar pattern to the Y. pylori stream. 9% of the samples that were taken in this stream, we took less samples, but 90% of those were high in the enterococci, 40% were high in Clostridia. But again, we did not see much in the way of fecal sources. We had one pig sample again that exceeded. And on the map, that was right at the top of the watershed here. Now, these groundwater seeps that were sampled, so these are the stream samples. These are the three groundwater seeps. There were three that were measured. They were measured on four occasions. And on one occasion, we got a very high hit. And this is that data shown right here. Very high for human fecal contamination. So undoubtedly, in this one sample, there was the presence of human fecal bacteria. We also looked at the injection wells to see, now you would expect to see a human signal in the groundwater injection wells. Six of them were sampled around the area of Poitou. And indeed, we did see strong human fecal signal in those. There was one sample that I just want to point out that actually had low enterococcus counts, even though it's straight from a wastewater injection well. And we saw this also with a couple of cesspools, where we saw a huge fecal signal, but the indicator tests, if you were just going by those numbers, would have told you that this sample is fine. So what I want to point out is that, and we've seen this in some other places, where the phylogenetic, because we were using so much DNA-based information about the diversity of organisms that are there, it gives us a much more sensitive indicator of actual fecal contamination that is way more sensitive than what you see with the standard indicator bacteria.
What is this, an injection well, and are those also cesspools, or those you sampled both different ones?
I'm actually almost at the very end, so let's we'll talk about that. And actually, I think the Department of Health could probably talk better than I can about what those are. And then finally, this is actually the final slide here with the results. The cave, the Makuai cave. Water and sediments were tested in the cave to see if there was any kind of transmission out of the cave of any sort of fecal signal, and we didn't see anything in the samples that were taken there. So the main conclusions that we reached were that fecal contamination is not the primary source of the enterococci bacteria found in either one of the streams that we tested. We did have sporadic detection of other fecal signals. We saw the big signal. We saw the ruminant signal in some of the samples. And we did see a weak signal from some possible human sources, but they were not linked to the changes in concentration of the enterococcus. So that's how we reached the conclusion that the enterococci were not associated with any of these human or animal sources. And then finally, we did see that one sample from the groundwater seep at the coast that did have a strong human signal. That was the one place where we did find strong signal from humans. And happy to answer your questions, and if anything doesn't get addressed, please write my email down and email me.
Your report mentioned clear evidence of false negatives, but you haven't discussed those today. Can you explain what you
meant?
Sure.
Actually, I did. Let's just go back to this one slide. So this is what I meant by false negative in the report. And there was actually some discussion between me and the Department of Health about this, calling this a false negative. I called this sample a false negative for enterococcus because if this if this assay is supposed to be an indicator of fecal contamination, and you sample a known fecal source and it gives you a low number, then what I did in the report is I called it a false negative.
In other words, if you're testing a cesspool that you know has human waste in it, and it gives you a low indicator for human source, you know that's a false negative. Because you
well, my test, the phylochip test gave us a very high number. So we expected a high number. We got a high number with phylochip. The enterococcus test gave us a low number. And so for monitoring, and this is around the country, this assay is being relied upon to detect fecal contamination. And what I wanted to point out was that we had samples where we knew there was fecal contamination because it was a fecal sample. It was a fecal-containing sample, cesspool, an injection well, wastewater injection well. And the enterococcus test came up low. So I view that if you're gonna call that a fecal indicator, it's got to indicate that there's a problem. It didn't indicate there was a problem in this case. Now, the test itself is fine. It's measuring enterococcus. It gave a low number. But you would expect, it just shows that enterococcus is not it's not a foolproof method. It can give you a low number when you have fecal contamination in isolated cases.
Don't hop. All right. I'll let Dr. Berg ask the next question. I'm sorry. I wanted to follow up on that, but I'll wait.
One other thing I'd like to point out here in your thing is that your phylochip simply measures the genetic biome.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea whether that genetic biome is alive or dead because it was just in an injection well or something. Mm-hmm. The Enterococcus and Clostridium are measuring live cultures.
Right.
All they measure is live cultures. So in a case there, that injection well, we don't know what else they injected into the well. But there was no live Enterococcus at that moment, although there was tons of protein. In effect, you're not measuring the same thing at all. And we've seen this in samples at, for example, Hanalei Bay Pavilion, where there is, Dr. Bain's study showed there was a large genetic component, large protein component, but there was no live Enterococcus there at all because the septic system killed it off, like we spoke. Or it was through the sand, it was broken off.
Yeah, no, that's a good thing to bring up. And the first thing to notice is that in this particular sample, there was live enterococcus, it was just a low number. And then actually the clostridia for the sample, which is this alternative tracer, was high. And so if it were a case where, you know, the biology was essentially killed off, but you still have the DNA, you wouldn't see one thing high and one low necessarily, but what it shows is that when you look at the DNA, yes, we're not making a distinction between live and dead in this case. So in essence, it's a more conservative detection method because we want to just see if there's any trace that any kind of fecal contamination has been present. Now, what's happened to it in the environment? This is less susceptible. So like with Allie Bain, she does work where in sunlight, she's found that this enterococcus is more inactivated, and you get lower numbers. And so in my view, that's not a great situation to have for something that you're relying upon to tell you whether or not you've got a problem, because something as simple as sunlight or shade can give you variable results with this indicator, which is the standard everywhere. And so, one of the things I'm doing is pointing out that this is, you know, in the future, more work needs to be done to refine the way we monitor water quality. And where things need to go is towards methods that are less susceptible to the types of interferences and confounding factors that we find in the environment, sunlight, shade, chemical effects that affect the survivability of these types of indicator bacteria and then impact our determination of whether or not water is safe or not. We need to move towards more sensitive and more specific tests that that tell you something more about what you have in the sample.
Okay. in finding Enterococcus in the stream for Clostridium perfringens, while you're not able to use the DNA phylochip to say what the source is, that's the way you ended the study, correct? You couldn't identify the source. You weren't meaning to tell the public that those bacteria won't make them sick, are you?
No, because we're not measuring pathogens. So this is not all of these tests are essentially proxies. So if you have if you see evidence that you have human waste there, you assume that the pathogens that also occur in human waste could be there. If you don't have any evidence via these indicator bacteria or something like phylochip that the waste isn't there, then that's probably good news. But okay. we are not specifically testing for pathogens because, like I pointed out earlier, there's many different types of pathogens. And
by pathogens, you mean something that
viruses, specific yeah. types of bacteria that are pathogenic. And so those aren't routinely monitored by Hawaii or anyone else.
No, the APA has told us that cow manure and pig manure can make a human as sick as wastewater spill in recreational water. So that means it's pathogenic when it can make a human sick, correct? That's what we're really
there
talking
are,
about.
There are, yes. Cow manure can have pathogens that can make people sick.
Yeah, they said equally concerning to human. The other thing I wanted to point out is things like Clostridium perfringens can cause gas gangrene, just a small prick in the foot. And Enterococcus is there. Your phylochip actually had the ability to detect a lot of other bacteria, bacteroides, viruses as well, but did you do that to that those waters with high Enterococcus counts?
Well, it only detects bacteria, so we aren't testing for viruses.
Bacteroides and, is a bacteria.
Yeah, and so there are pathogenic. So we test for E. coli. We test for almost the full diversity of bacteria that exists. Some of those bacteria are pathogenic.
Was that done in this case, though?
We tested for everything. Mm-hmm. However, we don't go as far as to say whether or not something is pathogenic or not because we use this barcoding gene, and that barcoding gene, so you have, it'll tell you you have E. coli there, for example. But there's many different strains of E. coli, and many E. coli don't make you sick. Same thing with the Clostridium. There are specific strains of those Clostridia that make you sick. And so we can't go as far as to tell you, yeah, you've got the strain that's going to make you sick. We can tell you, yeah, you've got this species there, but we don't go that far. So it's really not meant as a pathogen monitoring tool. It's meant as a, we're looking at the composition of microbes from a broader level. And so we're looking for evidence that there's contamination. We're not making an assessment of pathogens.
And 32% of your samples of the wild pilate had hit for human source. So if you had that result, would you think it would be maybe prudent to do a profile of the biosolid dump site bacteria, see what's in the soil or the waters below it, to find out if that might be a match for what's coming out in the Waiopili? Because last month on island, most stream bacteria dropped because we're in the dry season. But the Waiopili increased by 98%. It almost doubled in the number of enterococci that were found in 100 ml of water. So our concern is that with all the streams on island, this has been consistently and significantly elevated. Mm-hmm. And it's elevated even at a time where other streams go down. So something is feeding it. And wouldn't it make sense to at least test the soil and the water below that 45 plus?
I mean, as a scientist, I love more data. So I'm not going to say no to that. If there's more data generated, the great thing is we can always fold it in to the model that we've essentially built for Hawaii and see. No, we didn't specifically test that as a source. What we did was we tested downstream of that, we looked for the signatures of fecal contaminants that we have in our library. I mean, I'm always interested in that sort of thing. So,
and yeah. These bacteria, it's kind of like a chicken and the egg, right? They are gut bacteria. They get out in the environment, then they also seed in the environment, and they can grow in the environment, and they can replicate in the environment. But at some point, it's believed in general that they were in some gut of some animal, and then they morph and go into the
environment. That was the assumption early on, but that's one way they get out in the environment, and that does happen. But they grow endemically, and by endemic, I mean their habitat, their natural habitat, is the environment. They are not strictly confined to gut. I'm talking about the enteric oxide. Now, where the phylogenetic has an advantage here is that we measure thousands of bacteria, some of which do live in the environment, many of which don't. And so we look at all that information together, and so we're not reliant on one type of bacteria that may or may not grow in the environment. And I think that's kind of the Achilles heel of some of these other methods, where all the eggs are in one basket, and you got to hope that it doesn't actually exist out of the environment. You want something, some kind of fingerprint or some kind of signal that you know can only come from the gut of an animal, only come from a pathogen-containing source. And so that's what our goal is for what we do. Yeah.
I'm not a scientist. I just want to make sure I'm getting the read out of this presentation correctly. You concur that in the case of wild Billy Scream, the enterococcal bacteria count is off the charts,
right?
It's high. Okay? You concur it's high, way above allowable limits. The only thing this study shows is that DNA evidence, or whatever it is the phylogenetic is based on, says it's not human feces and it's not animal feces. But did you go the next step and say, what is it that's causing it to go up there? Or did the Department of Health?
We want to go that next step. We started to go that next step by looking at the stream sediments as a potential source. So my thought was, maybe during periods when you've got high flow, which is when you tend to get the high counts, you stir up the sediments more. And we know that those sediments, even though we didn't detect any fecal contamination in the sediments, those sediments are high in Enterococcus. And so potentially the sediments themselves might be a source. We didn't find that. So we looked for kind of those same relationships that I showed you where, okay, if Enterococcus goes up, we wanted to see, we looked for a sediment signal. We didn't see that. Now, there's many other potential environmental sources, the stream banks, the soils. It's a real challenging problem. And so what we wanted to do was rule out things that we know contain pathogens. So no one's shown that decaying vegetation or this naturally occurring soil, I mean, if those contain pathogens that get us sick, then we're doomed because it's everywhere. And so we wanted to rule out the things that are essentially unnatural or that we could potentially control and also contain pathogens, whether it's cattle, pigs, humans. Those are the things that we know contain things that can make us sick. We wanted to rule that stuff out because we're working against this very complex background where there's a lot of enteric oxide in Hawaiian soils. And so we're ruling it out. But no, we don't have a positive, we didn't track down that question.
That it's not these particular.
It's not the potential source. It's not the potentially harmful.
But you concur that it is grossly contaminated. It's not healthy.
I wouldn't call
If the
source is natural, then I wouldn't call it contaminated.
But you don't know yet if it is natural.
We don't. That is not a positive finding. Yeah, we're ruling stuff out. So, you know, you got a list of suspects. We're ruling out the suspects. I mean, if people can come to me and say, you know, here's something else that's potentially pathogen containing what you've done. You know, we can look at that.
So if you create a profile of the biosolid dump site and it matches the DNA in the stream, then you will have a hit, like you said.
If it were totally different from any other kind of human source that we've ever looked at, and it had some odd combination, but even if you did see a hit there, even if you did, the question is it a pathogen-containing source?
And what do you need to do to determine if it's pathogenic? Because we have numbers that range between 4,000 and 27,000 fecal indicator bacteria colony forming units in that 100 cc's.
Let me just explain that where we are in this. When you see, I think Eric did a great job at explaining enterococci. It is naturally found. In fact, it's a commensal bacteria that's helpful for our digestion. And that's why you would see it in our feces, and it would indicate that if we're going to be exposed to human sewage, it could contain a waste pathogen. So this happens to be one of the quicker indicators, like said, we look for. It does not necessarily mean that it correlates well with is it really going to be make us sick. For example, let me explain the 130. The 130 is actually the EPA suggested statistical threshold value not to exceed 10% of the time. However, DOH uses it as a not to exceed number because as a beach manager, you can't say, well, I'm going to wait until I've got a lot of samples, and then when 10% are exceeding, then we'll notify the public. We're using it to be very conservative, so we're using that as a not to exceed number. And the interesting thing about enterococci or any recreational water quality indicator, and this is probably the only one EPA has done as a recommendation, this number is not like most pollutants. In other words, some toxic element, take any of the things like lead or whatever. We use a dose response curve to pick absolutely, you know, if you exceed this particular value, then we're going to have significant harmful effects in humans. This is not how it's derived. This number was statistically derived based on epidemiological studies. We have people go out to the beach and we go follow up with a survey and said, did you get sick? Did you go in the water? And then we ran all the information about who got sick and whether or not they got exposed to the water in some way. They swam in it or ingested water or whatever. And then we then tracked that and determined that we started to see people expressing gastrointestinal illness when a certain number, we saw the number at 35. We use that as the geometric mean, sort of like the median or an average. And then we derived the 130 based on, I think it's like the 80th percentile or something like that. Anyway, so in other words, it's statistically derived. We can't say that 130 makes you sick. That's actually not true. It's just that we want to be cautious, and when we start to approach that number, we might potentially have more pathogenic kind of gastrointestinal illness might start showing up. So this is why this is so difficult, because it's not a number that if you exceed it's safe or not safe. And this is why I think that some of you may have read the Environment America report. That's actually not the best way to characterize whether or not a water is safe. And DOH will never say it's safe or not, because there's a lot of things that make...
Wait, Bruce just did that.
Who's that?
Bruce Anderson, head of Department of Health, just said that the water at Wild Pili Stream was safe.
No, he didn't. I don't think he
said
it.
Yes,
he
did.
It was in his press release.
Oh, okay.
That's one of the things that really... really got us was that he was coming out.
Well, whether or not I don't want to dispute whether what he said, but I'm just trying to explain what this value is and why we did this study. because when you start seeing enterococcus that might be higher than EPA's recommended number, we suggest that we actually trace the source. And this is what Eric was doing for us. It's a microbial source tracker. And the reason is because the more human it is, obviously, you're going to have more potential for us getting sick. Also, cattle. Cattle, we wouldn't rule out that exposure to a cattle fecal source would also potentially make us sick. There are many studies that looked at some of the other wildlife, and the and pigs, chicken, and other gulls. When you look at the curve of the illness rates protracted by exposure to those types of feces, the risk to humans goes way down. So this is why we took this next step to find out what are the sources, because that's really important to know if you're getting high counts of enterococci. Again, like Eric said, it does not tell you then what is the risk. So this is, if we can do it here, one of the things that we want to venture into is the next step that the EPA would recommend, which is to do something called the quantitative microbial risk assessment. With the similar indicators or any other potentially better indicators that might be good for Hawaii, we want to now look specifically for the etiological agents or the things that are the pathogens that might be associated with these particular indicators. And look specifically for that because, and depending on the type of sources, we want to specifically look at norovirus or campylobacter because there's been a number of studies that suggest that if you've got only chicken sources, there's still certain other pathogens, actual pathogens, that would make us ill. And those are the things that we'll be specifically looking for. And then when we do the association with how much risk would it pose, given that it's not human, this is kind of the next step. Because even if we're getting high counts of entero, if it's not human, but it could be from pigs, then what would be our risk? And that's what the quantification of the next step we'd like to venture into, if you're interested in that.
This phytochip, is this an EPA-approved test for this?
Right now, the field of source tracking is, there's no one standard way of doing it, and there's a bunch of methods out there. We're working with EPA right now, and they're testing it all over the country.
Okay. Well, given the kind of the conflicting conclusions of your report,
can you clarify what you mean by conflicting?
I think it's safe to say that there is a relationship between bacterial contamination in water and potential disease. And would you say that that is true?
No.
That there is no given relationship. It is not common.
There is a relation. So when you look at the justification for using the enterococci in the EPA guidelines, they point out they go into big detail about what the justification is for using them. And there were a series of what are called epidemiological studies that established a relationship between enterococcus and illness rates for locations that were affected by wastewater treatment plants. Most of the studies that have shown that relationship have had these point sources of human contamination. Now, they've done a couple.
Why would the source even matter?
It does matter. That's the thing. It does matter because a human source has a higher probability of containing human pathogens because humans carry their own pathogens than a bird source. That's not to say that other animals don't carry pathogenic bacteria, but the natural wildlife has less pathogens that affect humans than human sewage, for example. And then soils have less of a risk. They have less pathogens. So that's kind of the point here, is that in a case where, yeah, if it were all coming from sewage, and then you can make that assumption, absolutely, that the higher those numbers, the more risk there is. But if the enteric cocci, those indicator bacteria, are coming from natural sources or wildlife or something else that has less pathogens in it to start, then those relationships break down. And so that's why figuring out the source matters in this case, because if it's a human source, we want to know, because that's the worst possible source you can have. If it's something that is not even an animal, it's unlikely to be harmful.
Even if the counts are in the thousands consistently every month?
Yeah. Yeah, and the reason for that is, one reason for that, because we did not make that final determination, but one reason for that is that the background enteric cocci numbers in soils naturally, in a warm,
that's
wet place like Hawaii.
That's where it's born and begins?
Yes. Yeah.
But why isn't it anywhere else on the island like Waipili?
It is.
In these numbers, why are
they?
They
are actually. We found in the stream itself. Our data show that the stream, the magnitude of Enterococcus, those numbers of Enterococci that we found in Waipili stream are pretty much identical. We found them in the thousands in Waipili stream.
Where else?
In my data, this is my data. I don't know anything else about the rest of the island.
So my last follow-up question, and then I'll give the floor to someone else. So given that your report has conflicting information, questionable results, is the phylo chip going to be used as a test in the future, either here on Kauai or on Hawaii? Because it doesn't seem like it's had a best start. What is the future of this phylochip test?
The future, I don't know what it is on Kauai, but the future is that it's going to be used because it works well. I'm not quite sure where you're making the conclusion that it's not working well.
I mean, you didn't find the source.
Did
the whole thing.
No, the goal was to rule out potentially harmful sources, and we achieved that goal. It did its job.
Even with the false negatives?
But the false negatives weren't with the phylochip test, they were with the Enterococcus test.
But
that's not clear from the report. You might want to go back and look at an ending of your report that made it sound like your phylochip had false negatives.
Yeah, well, but that's what I'm trying to clarify here, is that the negative values, that final conclusion that you're referring to was that we, the phylochip, in a known human source, gave us a human signal, and the Enterococcus gave us a low number. So that's not a false negative for the phylochip. It's positive. It's a true positive because it was a human source. The phylochip told us it was a human source. Enterococcus told us did not indicate fecal contamination.
Just above the section that begins with conclusions, it actually reports the phylochip gave false negatives. So I think you may want to look at your report.
Okay.
Sorry, Jeff. Has anyone else replicated the data you found in this study using phylochip or other methods?
No, this is our lab conducted the study, and we generated data, and we wrote the report.
I'd like to get back to your initial sources. And so when you're trying to determine the signal of the human source, say specifically, you're trying to determine the signal strength there. What you used was four stool samples and cesspool samples, right?
Mm-hmm.
Were they mixed totally and looked at as a composite or separately?
No, they're looked at separately because we want to have a number of different representatives of the same source because there's variability between one cesspool to the next or one human to the next or one sewage to the next.
You have two graphs in your paper. One is the clade diagram, the wisp, which shows that your human stool samples were separate from the cesspool.
Correct.
The other one was, I don't know, picture it, it had all the different dots from all the different samples. And again, the human stool were way up in the right-hand corner,
yeah,
and the others were here.
That's right.
And the point I make is that I don't think you use a proper source, because you use a stool sample from some howlies in California, which probably have a very different biome in our multiracial group here on Hawaii. And the fact, this is also borne out in the fact that different populations have different mm-hmm. concentrations of Clostridium perfringens. In mm-hmm. fact, some have none at all, mm-hmm. which could be why we're getting such low counts of Clostridium in Hawaii, because the population doesn't have it. So your signal strength for humans could have been artificially depressed because it was not matching up to a California stool sample, which was inappropriate.
So the reason that we sampled the cesspools was because we wanted representation in Hawaii. And so what the model does is it looks for bacteria that are in common. There are bacteria that, so the bacteria that vary between the Californians and the Hawaiians are not ultimately used to make the determination of the presence of the source. What it's looking for, there are bacteria that it doesn't matter where you are on Earth, people are going to have those types of bacteria. And so the model accounts for that kind of variation, and it really is focused in on the bacteria that are in common.
Right. If, for example, though, you went back to look at your data and just pull out the stool samples saying they're not necessarily appropriate and reanalyze that, that could possibly change your signal strength. Because you're putting in a negative value.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It could change the signal strength. That's possible.
Okay.
I'm not saying this, and I played around with that actually, and there's minor variations. What it will not change, though, is that whether or not there's a relationship between the Enterococcus and that signal. So, you know, if you look at one of these diagrams, This is not a relationship. There's no correlation between this signal. So if you do what you're suggesting, these will move around either up or down slightly. I mean, we're talking very small amounts. It's not going to change. And that's why we have, I did say that we have a bit of a gray zone here with a couple of samples where they're borderline. And so I say that's a weak signal because it could change it slightly, but it will not change whether or not it's related to Enterococcus.
Okay, so let me just follow on here. In your graph there that you have on the x-axis the concentration of Enterococcus. However, your data is not all ordinal numbers, because the Department of Health does not read greater than 2005. So your counts on the far right-hand side could be 20,000 or something like
that. Yeah, and that would make the relationship even worse. Because this point could be way over here, like you're suggesting. In order to have a positive relationship, the point needs to be up here somewhere.
Right.
It's this axis. These are the highest counts for here, and you're right, some of these ping the needle. They're at 2005. This number, if it was from a human source, ought to be up here.
But the other thing, the other aspect is some of their numbers are less than 10. So they cannot be used in this kind of correlation graph or statistics because
it's not
a real number. But let me carry through here. You have had, for some reason, I mean, because your scientists do it, you have drawn that line at 0.2 for the association of the probability that there is a human signal. And what you said is you use 0.2 for and above for a strong signal, and 1 to 2 for a moderate signal, and then less than 1 would be a nominal signal, according to your paper. Mm-hmm. A nominal signal, which means that it is present, but that it's below, in a sense, your limit of quantification. So when your numbers are then taken to policy by the head of the Department of Health, for example, who says there's there's conclusive evidence that there's no human factor involved. That was, I think, a quote. What I see in looking at your data is you, in fact, have some numbers that are 0.19 or point 1.87. They're just below that line.
Yeah.
That means that there was.
That's why I call it moderate signal.
Right. Okay.
Because if there was any, you know, slight variation, we could get over. Now, yeah. Every test in the world has some kind of detection limit.
Right. And you didn't present your variance or your standard deviation on that detection limit, on your signal strength. But the other thing, in looking at your data, there are, and it shows up here, there are about 10 or 12 values that are above 0.05. So I just arbitrarily said, well, let me just look at what is 0.05. And just to say that's a nominal, that's a plus. Yes, humans were taken, it's a plus or minus statistics. And if you do that, then you find that for Wild Peely Ditch, you have about 32.6% of your samples have a nominal signal for human. And for Waycomo Stream, it's more like 40% have a signal there. So this, as a scientist, this would say I should look more closely at those lower numbers. I should do more sampling, which is what you said. Do more sampling. But where I'm aghast, where the Department of Health comes out and says there was conclusively no human signal found, therefore we can absolve, for example, Grow Farm from any liability on this, when in fact you do have data there. And I don't know, you didn't explain well enough in your paper, I guess for some people, the idea that there is a strong signal and a moderate signal, and then there are these other signals that are there. The other thing you didn't do in here, looking at your sources, you did not look at our huge feral cat population and our huge feral dog population and our huge multi-species rat population that live out in those fields. So if you're doing a source tracking, you're trying to identify it, you miss three very probable sources of contamination. And so this is a good start. I appreciate your doing this. But I have problems in how your data is being presented through the initial reports to the public by the Department of Health.
So I want to address the first question about the detection limit. So we have done studies where we have looked at what point are the enterococcus, does our signal drop in that range that you're talking about? And we've tracked sewage spills, and we've done experiments in our lab where we've spiked samples with the fecal contaminants so that we can nail down where our limit is, where we know that we lose signal, and what is the relationship to the indicator bacteria? Because we want to see, can we see the fecal signal where, you know, there's a concern? Because if we can't see the fecal signal and you've got higher enterococcus numbers, then we're not performing well, because you could have high enterococcus and not see a signal. And where we lose our human signal is well below where you lose the enterococcus signal. Okay, so if you're in this range and you're not seeing a human signal, you need that signal. If it's not up above this line, there is not, or you know, close to it, then there's no human. It's not there. I mean, that's just the detection limit.
Is your signal number, I thought you said that's a probability.
It's a proportion in the model. I mean, I know you want to see the nitty-gritty details, and I have the paper to send.
On a more basic level, if people in this room are in agreement that there's high in pterococcal contamination in Wild Billy Stream, right? We all agree to that? So the question is, you were hired to try and figure out what it was, and you figured out it wasn't fecal, either human or animal, but it's something else. The issue is it pathogenic? Will it cause illness in humans? Does the Department of Health know? I don't know. It seemed to me that we could just divide the room in half. This half over here, with the government people in it, they get to bathe every day in Wild Pili Stream water, all right? The other half of the room, they use regular drinking water from the Department of Water Sources, okay? And then 2 weeks later, we'll see who got sick and who didn't.
You know, we need to do that study because it would be great to have more epidemiological information for Hawaii. But I say that facetiously because...
But at a minimum, instead of taking feces from the...
Would you take your kids swimming in Wild Pili Stream?
I would, because... What?
Without testing the biosolid dump site, without knowing whether or not there's a match.
Yeah, I would. I would take my kids there.
There's 269 dry metric tons a year dumped in there for 11 years in Diskin.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not disputing that would be an interesting test to do.
Do you know why it wasn't done,
Roger? No, I don't.
And well, you're why actually commercially done? Advancing... The phylochip, are you not?
We get requests all the time to use it, and one of the limitations we have is that we're a research lab, and so what EPA is evaluating right now is whether or not it would be a test that they want to apply routinely around the country. And if that happens, it needs to be commercially available. So this is something that has been discussed because otherwise. Just like any technology, it needs to be available to water testing labs and other entities. Otherwise, it's just a research tool.
I have a quick question. Since we're focusing on both streams, are both streams annual flowing streams, or are they seasonal streams? And if so, if they are seasonal, were the samples taken during low flows through the streams and increase the concentration?
So there were four collection times in the streams. Two were during lower flow periods, and two were during higher flow periods. And they were, so the Waipuli Ditch and the Waikoma Stream were running all the time, but there were tributaries and areas upstream that were dry. In Waikoma's always running, but there were a few locations where, yeah, during the dry periods, they weren't sampled. And so those high, in that one graph here, the March sampling dates had the highest concentrations actually occurred during the higher runoff period. So it appears that more stuff is flushing in during the higher runoff period. Now that, so generally that's the case, but then there's some variation. And you can have cases, and we'd have to look at the data because I don't know offhand, but I know in some areas that we've done work where you have stagnant water, sometimes stagnant, you know, ponds and so forth, that actually has higher numbers of the indicator bacteria as well. So you can get it in various ways. You can get sort of stagnation and sometimes growth, or you can get it flushing in. But in this case, the highest concentrations of the Waipuli Stream were during the higher flow periods.
When the stream was actually going through a flushing period, perhaps?
Sure. I mean, yeah, there's more runoff coming.
Because Waikoma is constant. Because Waikoma is constant.
No, they're both constant. What I mean is, if you think of it, you know, sort of as... let me just pull up that sampling map.
You might have been drawing from a more distant part of the watershed than you have higher flow.
They both run all the time. The streams run, both of the streams run all year long. The sampling that you... And we have measurements of the flow rate in some of these streams, in Waipuli Stream. It's not a ditch, it's a stream. And in this stream, we have that, but in your data, you did not have any measurements of the flow rate of that stream, so you have no real quantitative idea of whether it was a flushing event or a regular event or anything like that. So it's really, really hard, based on only four samples, and two in each thing, to make any conclusion about changes in flushing rate.
Yeah, no, we're not pairing this with any specific flushing rate data. We're just trying to see if when what the relationship is between the Pterococcus and fecal sources. That's it. I mean, that's the primary goal of the study. I mean, that's the limit of the scope of the study.
Yeah. So the you found really interesting results for the seats, and I think that's you have the picture up there. Okay, the seats. Now, when you didn't sample any seeps at Mahalapu? No. Okay. You where surf rider samples, which is at the high water mark, where the stream always flows at that point, even though they block it off further. This is undoubtedly a seep. And our salinity measurements show that it's, even though it's in a sense intertidal, that it is fresh water all the time. And our very credible data shows that we have a geometric mean of 71 samples, which is 8,800. And we never go below 1,000. The average is over 10,000. So why there is a major difference between our site, which is at the borderline between growth farm property and public property, and your site 12, which is above the cave. There's no rationale for why you sampled at the cave except to protect the growth farm. No one ever suspected there was high bacteria counts there. No one expected there was water to flow there. But what our data shows is that because we are consistently getting high counts, it's not from stream flow, and we have those measurements, but it's because there is groundwater seep coming out at that spot. And I would bet that, and this is what I hope you can do in the future, is if you were to do the phyto chip at that, you're testing a seep. And in this case, we have no idea where it's drawing the water from, whether it's upper Mahalapu Valley or whether it's off to the left where all this sewage sludge and by regular accounts, raw sewage was dumped on the property and ponds that were there. So it's just a matter of a few hundred yards between where our seep samples are and where Department of Health took a few samples of the stream. And so I think this is the people here are concerned because we're getting extremely high Enterococcus bacteria counts that are in the tens of thousands. And at the same time, we don't have this source tracking going on in the worst spot in Mahalapu.
Yeah, I mean, if it's downstream, if the source is downstream from our last sample, then that's correct. I mean, we're not picking, we're the goal was to see what was coming through Waipili Stream. And so what we can say is the sources that we tested for, we don't see those sources. But I can't say one way or another what's going on beneath our last sample there.
Right. And then, again, your report has been taken into the public domain about how safe is the water. And what you can say is that there is some human source of low signal strength in coming down to the high tide mark. And then what Surfrider is saying is, yeah, but we think there's another source, a seep source or something right there that tells us that we have extremely high concentrations and therefore the public health is at risk.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way of knowing what's in that seep unless
you do
the source of testation or not. Well, Carl, as a surf rider fan, if you're concerned about the seep and not the stream, why don't you say that in your blue water data?
Because the seep comes up out and forms the water, forms the stream. All of the water that hits the ocean is from the stream, and at some point in that stream, we haven't dug and looked somewhere in there, is a, we're saying a seep.
Groundwater seep.
That
well,
is.
I'll look forward to that. And also, there's the issue of the tidal flow. So, if there's a seep at the
mouth of the river, and then the river tides, the stream tides go up and down. Would that take some of the seep source into the stream?
It would, Burl, but what our 70-something samples have shown is the salinity only on one occasion, a super high storm tide that went way up past the cave, sent the salt water up. Every other thing is we have salinities of 0.1 or 0.2. So 0.2. So there is, like, even though the salt water is there and coming in the sand, there is such a freshwater flux.
But it does go as high as the ridge.
At times it does. And we don't sample high flow rate, low flow rate, or rainfall, or high or low tide. We just go and sample on the second Saturday of the month. So with over 5 years, we've picked this up.
What we're faced with, I think, is a very living environment with so many variables and many more tests that could possibly sort things through. But I have to say, I'm impressed with this test. I'm impressed with your methodology, and I'm impressed that the DOH was willing to do it. So more to come, maybe, but thank you very much.
Yeah. And it is.
I don't know if anybody's recording this, but just for the record, to address a couple of things that have been mentioned. One of them is that while these are both permanently flowing streams, not all of the streams are permanently flowing. As you suggested, some of the upper levels of those streams are dry for part of the year. Second point is that you look at the old maps, Waiopili isn't a stream. It was a dug ditch to drain the swamp, as best I can determine. And the third thing is there's absolutely a reason to test inside the Makawai Cave, because there's standing water inside the Makawai Cave, so you can get access to groundwater there. And I'm glad you did that.
It's tidal.
Thank you.
Inside the cave, it's tidal.
It's tidal, but it's groundwater.
But each time you run one of these, you can set the profile for the phylochip, and that's what you were doing with the fecal samples you used from the mainland, right? And so if you go back to the biosolid dump site and test the soil and the groundwater there, you can reestablish a profile that then you can use to measure what you're finding in the Waiopili at the various levels, because the numbers differ depending upon where you are in the Waiopili. But you could potentially match up and see whether that profile...
Yeah, if the profile, you know, whatever was sampled, that could be the potential source. And we can profile anything. I mean, everything has bacteria in it, and everything has a unique diversity of bacteria on it. And
you started to say that earlier, the different cesspools. Yeah. And
I mean, that's why I'm in this game, is because it's really cool that we have this whole diverse ecosystem that lives on our skin, that lives in our guts, and it lives just about everywhere there's water or carbon. And so there's a lot that could be done in terms of, you know, it's nature's fingerprint, in a sense.
Thank you.
That question is more for the Department of Health people. I mean, you issued permits for 11 years running for aqua engineers to dump sewage waste on Mahalapu. Were there ever tests done on that site to determine that whether or not there was any contamination as a result of that? Was it your office that issued the permits to aqua engineers?
Unfortunately, it's not from my office. It's not from my program. It's a different program. You know, they deal with that, they handle with that solid disposal site. So I have no answer for you, but you know, maybe I can go back to ask, you know, the other program, whoever they...
Did you specifically exclude that as a test site for Eric's study? Were you told to test there or not test there?
How long did the fecal pathogens of concern survive in the environment after
their exposure? Well, like I said earlier, we know from degradation studies, because there's a lot of interest in this, how long can a fecal survive outside its host? And the answer is
a lot less than the time that sewage has been in that disposal site. So it would be a finding of great interest to science if it was rich in pathogens, because it hasn't been shown that you can have huge reservoirs of pathogens like that that are going to survive outside their host. I mean, they're really, you know, they depend on the warm temperatures and the ecological conditions within their hosts, and so that that is a reason I think why it wasn't sampled, because the what we wanted to see were there live living hosts that were potentially contributing to the water quality, and potentially, you know, if you see that there is an association with those particular hosts, then that's when you start to get concerned, because then you could have freshly deposited pathogens.
Which you only know if you test for it. But the Watson and Kubo, who was in this, the area that Mr. Honda's in now, told us that if the fecal material gets into the karst lava tubes that are there under the surface and is kept moist and dark and warm, the bacteria can persist, he said, well beyond 10 years in the environment. And I think that's the whole idea you were getting at earlier when you said these bacteria do live in the environment and do become part of the environment.
Not the pathogen.
Yeah, the question was specifically about the pathogen. So there are organisms that form spores that we're using as indicators. Yeah.
And so how do you test for pathogenic? Because that's, I think, what one of the concerns is. Has any test been done to determine if the high counts of bacteria that are present in the Waiapili are pathogenic or not?
Yeah, that's a question for the DOH.
Yeah, I mean, what we're doing is it falls within kind of the EPA framework, which is that they go to these indicator bacteria because it's a challenge, and in some cases impossible, to do quantification of pathogens in the environment. And they're seen as a conservative way of looking at the potential presence of pathogens. And so that's why they're used to begin with, is they're a conservative indicator of potential pathogen presence.
That's what Ms. Hashimoto was saying earlier, that when they did the epidemiological studies, which is the doctors who determine, who track people that got sick, they said after 130 bacteria in 100 mil.
But those were done, but then those were done where the source was kind of freshly deposited into that waterway where they did that study. So those were done where upstream of that there was an active wastewater treatment plant. And that was,
that had a spill.
Or leaking or whatever it was. Yeah. And so those weren't done where you had a source such as, you know, something that's been sitting out there for years and years. The concern is that when you have a live human source or a sewage that is freshly deposited, that contains pathogens, and that's where those relationships really hold up, because those pathogens co-occur with the enterococcus.
In this case, the biosolid dump site was there, and when they did test the beach was always clean. It had no enterococci until 2011. So that was after the dump site had been there 8 years, and the first uptick was 254 enterococci in 2011. Between 2011 and 2014, the number rose to the thousands, and it's been in the thousands ever since. So it's, if you really want to know what the source is, what we don't understand, Mr. Dubinsky, is if you really want to know the source, and you know you have a huge area that got dumped on for 11 years, and for the first 8 of that 11 years you didn't see it, but then you started to see it, and you saw it go into exponential numbers. The question is, what's happened? What might be growing underground where it's warm and dark and damp, you know, and whether or not it's pathogenic, you say, well, they don't really test for it, but they used these epidemiological studies and they chose a conservative number because they said after 130 people got sick. Well, we're in the thousands. We're well above 130. So And we do have people, you know, we have the anecdotal stories of people that have been down there throwing net in the water, bad ear infections, flu-type symptoms, rhinitis, sinusitis. I mean, if the medical records of the community were studied, there is evidence that people that have frequented the recreational or recreationally used those waters did get ill. So the question is, if you really want to know the source, what we don't understand is, why wasn't a giant area that, you know, when you're talking 45 plus or minus acres, in one of the permits it added up, it was a total of 54 acres. Whatever it was used regularly and heavily dumped on with secondarily treated human waste for 11 years. So it doesn't make sense that there's not been any effort to, whether you do it with a phylochip, go in and test the soil and the water, or whether you run enterococcus samples on the soil or the water, because both can be done, correct?
Yeah, you could do those tests. And I mean, it would be quite odd that you would have pathogens outliving the Clostridia that we rely on to make a human source determination, because a lot of what's in your gut are Clostridia, harmless Clostridia. I mean, they're not pathogenic, or else we'd all be in big trouble. But they're there in very high numbers. And so it would be really a strange situation if those pathogens were living that long and our Clostridia weren't. So, you know, without...
There were high counts of Clostridia in the Waiopili.
Yeah, but they don't... in the samples we tested, because I can only speak to samples that were part of this study.
Those are the four. The two in the dry season and the two in the wet season.
At all the locations, correct.
And those locations were just on the stream.
The stream, we sampled the cave, but yeah, and sediments in the stream. That's correct. The study is focused on the stream. So that's where the study was focused, and we don't see the Clostridia that are indicative of human fecal material. And those are a very conservative, like I showed in some of the data, you know, our signals persist even longer than the indicator bacteria. So if those thousands of Enterococcus were coming from that area, it would be odd that the human bacteria that would have been associated with them aren't also detectable.
One of the things that I'd like to ask was the, Gary, was the Gillen cesspool tested? In your paper, you did not indicate where the cesspools were. You had the injection wells and the thing. But I couldn't find where the cesspool samples were.
Yeah, they were from, I didn't do that sampling. From what I know, they were individual households.
Right, well, because there is a household less than 100 yards from the stream, right on the rock bench there. And so the high source that we get from this sea could be coming from that cesspool area, although he shut it down once the testing began. Again, I don't know how much that is used, but that would give you a very important signal of a human source right within the watershed of Mahalapu Waiapili, as opposed to like Homo.
Yeah, I mean, we have a very large and growing library of human sources, and they'd have to be on some really wacky diet if it wasn't within kind of the variation that we've seen, because humans have a pretty, I mean, there's variability, no doubt, but there's a lot of commonality. Now, again, I mean, if you're talking about areas we haven't sampled, I can't say what's in those samples.
So you mentioned you said there was no correlation between the sediment samples and the stream samples. Well, the water samples.
Yeah, what I was looking for was a signal from the sediments themselves that was correlated with the Enterococcus.
Right. So the problem I have there is that you never sampled Waikomo stream sediments, or at least you didn't present the data. But you do make a generalization that there was no correlation. And then the other aspect was that your sediment samples, your two sediment sample periods, were 2 weeks different from when you did the water samples that you were trying to correlate them to. And
yep.
We know it's so, the animals down there are so sporadic running around through the pigs and everything, that there is not probably a constant source like going into the streams. So it would be extremely unlikely that there would be a correlation between sediment samples and stream samples 2 weeks apart, especially in the rainy season.
I think it would be even more unlikely that the streams, you know, at all those locations within a two-week period would have a wholesale rearrangement of their microbial diversity to the point where we wouldn't see a stream sample. And again, what I was looking for was an association with the Enterococcus. So if I, you know, even if there was a slight difference in the composition, it's we should have seen. And the reason we didn't do it in Lycoma is because we were really focused in on the Y pill. We wanted to look compare the sediments that underlie the waters that we're testing. And so it was really just to kind of give us a microbial benchmark to work from. The goal there was just to rule in or rule out the sediments themselves as a possible source of enterococci. And then at the time point that we sampled, we did not see sources within the sediments. I would love to have, in any study I do, I'd love to have, you know, way more data than I ever have. It's always a matter of what is feasible, what's within the budget. And so what was in the budget was, you know, we worked with DOH on this, and there was a certain budget, and how many samples can we do with that budget, and how can we kind of maximize, the information we could get with the money and manpower we had. And so, you know, that really is how it works and how we arrived at, you know, our frequency of sampling and that sort of thing.
I still don't understand why it is that the DOH has not ordered testing done at a known sludge dump in the vicinity of Wild Billy Stream. You don't think it's appropriate to test both the soil and the subsurface area around the known sludge dump that you permitted for 11 years running? No answer.
I think, like Alex said, that's a different office. We're not responsible.
Oh, okay. We're not.
But I've spoken to the chief of that office, and I was told that the facility was permitted and the facility was required to test.
I understand that, but it was never tested.
It was tested. They were required.
Where are the results of that test?
We didn't. We don't.
You're clean water, right?
Yeah, we're not wastewater.
And the water there is clean, huh?
Wastewater.
Yeah. The wastewater is clean.
The wastewater people aren't here.
The wastewater people aren't here.
I think that the lady, I mean, she's been raised her hand maybe 10 times already, yeah. And then still never catch her.
No problem. Thank you, Eric, for coming to Kaloa, especially after the holiday boom. I find it really interesting that there is the Enterococcus in the soil sediment. I have, please forgive my layman questions, first off, and it's kind of a two-parter. I think you sort of covered my first question, which is, does the phylochip test detect bacteria living or dead? It sounds like it does have to be living.
No. We extract DNA from intact cells, so that doesn't necessarily mean that they're dead or living. No, it does not make that particular distinction. Now, we're filtering cells out of the water. If those cells recently died, we'll see that DNA.
Okay, and then my second part is, situations like injection wells or the sludge spread in the Whiskey Echo area over the lava tubes, since that has been semi-treated, are those, is the Enterococcus still viable? Do those chemicals change the makeup that the phylochip would detect?
Well, the Enterococcus test, that is looking for live. So I'm making the distinction between the Enterococcus test and the phylochip test. So the Enterococcus test is the one that, you know, I showed that petri dish and the other thing. It's looking for active cells, cells that are still alive, and that's what's being measured there. If the DNA is there and the cells are intact, alive or dead, we'll see that DNA. So it's a little bit different, and what we're trying to find are just traces of fecal contaminants. And so we don't really care if it's recently dead, because we just want to see, okay, is there a potential waste stream that's coming in here? And so we like to be conservative that way. Because if we're looking for just live things, we'll be probably a little less sensitive. We're just looking for some DNA evidence that something was there or not.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sure. It helps me to understand your report better. And also, I just wanted to state that since 2011, we have seen probably about a 3-time increase in the amount of rainfall in that area. As far as the sludge area. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. I've gone to the people over there asking about the land application. The engineer, I'm trying to get her over here, but she's on her vacation. She has all the records. They do testing every month for that landfill. And what I do, we have grids. I have a GPS. And when we put the sewage on the grids, I GPS that thing, make sure the flow is not going towards any stream. But our engineer is on vacation because this was clear water thing. It wasn't about sewer, yeah? So we can get the information to whoever's asking from the DOH, our sampling. That is no problem. But the thing is, I GPS the thing. Every time they dump, I make sure that it's not going towards the stream. And we have sand, dirt, in case, you know, we have a berm, a 4-foot berm around there to contain, like how you contain fuel. You know, we contain everything there. So, you know, that's why she's not here today, but sorry.
Okay. Is the dump site operational now?
No. Because the dairy thing, you know, and if they want proof, we could show them, but that's okay. It's over. Yeah. So, we can get you guys all that information if you need to.
Can I ask a quick question? How are the sample sites chosen? I know you touched up briefly on how you had a limited amount of money for, you know, the amount of samples that you wanted to collect or whatever, but how are they specifically chosen?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the samples in the Waipili area were essentially based on sample sites that were chosen by DOH previously to monitor. So we just went back to the same sites. And then there were a few inserted, a few additional samples that were inserted there. What I wanted to see with both Waikomo and Maulepu was that we went from kind of upstream up into the forested area, and in Waikomo, above where the houses are, because I wanted to try to have a sample that at least wasn't impacted by on-site disposal systems like cesspools and that sort of thing. And then kind of did a transect down to the mouth of each one of those areas.
So some were chosen by the Department of Health previously, and some were chosen by you.
Yeah, well, we went out with the Department of Health initially, and we did kind of a scoping site, and we went around and you know, discussed what would make for a good kind of study plan to try to capture what was happening from upstream to downstream. Yes?
So the samples were taken in 2016 and 2017. Mm-hmm. Your report recently came out. Can you tell us how the samples were preserved? And why were they preserved until this time?
So what our samples, when the samples were collected, they went to the Department of Health. And then they do their tests immediately, because those are live tests. Those need to be done. Those tests need to be started within hours. With DNA, those samples can be frozen, and they're preserved for years if they're kept at a very cold temperature. And so once all the samples were collected, because we didn't start anything on our end until we received all the samples, which was at the end of the summer in 2017. And then what happened was our laboratory picked up and moved. We shut down for almost 6 months. We moved to a different campus. So we had to shut down our equipment, move. We didn't start anything until we calibrated everything. We had to get the operators. We used some specialized equipment to image the pilot, wash and image the chip and that sort of thing. So that whole process, I mean, moving laboratory is a big deal. And then it just was a matter of getting the samples run, doing the analysis, and that just, we had other projects going. It took a while to get it done on our end. And then we gave the report to DOH early this year. And so that was kind of the timeline for all of that.
There was, I just had a question. In a situation such as this, where you have a waterway that's not moving much, the lower part, it's not entirely stagnant, but it feels stagnant, it looks stagnant, which supports a really high Enterococcus population, is it likely or possible that there would be pathogenic populations in there as well, even lacking mammalian or avian inputs? I mean, is that just a breeding ground for bacteria and viruses?
I'm not a pathogen expert. I'm really more of a bacteria expert. And so I don't know. I don't want to say one way or the other on that, because I'm not familiar with that research that addresses that. I mean, there probably is some. I mean, I know more about, okay, what are the pathogen burdens in animals? And I know that they're a lot less in the environment. But a situation you're describing, the question is, you know, could there be elevated pathogens in that scenario that were completely not from any kind of animal host? And I don't know the answer to that.
In our case with why feeling being stagnant, our greatest concern are the leptospirals that give us leptospirosis. Right. And those are passed through from cattle, horses, pigs, rats, and everything. And they have, they do live for a long time, weeks at least, in the water. And so there are some that are animal associated,
which is an argument for
that. That could stay in there, but that's really an exception. And it's here in Hawaii, because we have the warm water all year long, mm-hmm. there's a huge problem in the Midwest with cattle ponds, but they freeze in winter. So. Mm-hmm. But that is one pathogen that is well known to inhabitants of stagnant ponds. Mm-hmm.
Do you still have samples?
We have some DNA preserved. You know, we use a lot for the pilot chip.
I guess we still have some archives. Could you at some point, if the department asked you to, go back and use those samples and test for the animals that Carl mentioned, the rats and cats and dogs?
I mean, I could even, if the money was there to pay me to do a little more work, I could actually do that right now, because I have rats and dogs and cats in our library. But yeah, I don't know what kind of dog food you guys feed your animals with. But we don't have Hawaiian dogs or Hawaiian rats.
Do you foresee future testing and expansion of this project?
That really is up to DOH, the people who have purse strings. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, water quality is an ongoing issue, and you know, I have no idea what comes next. I'm just a dumb scientist who runs the samples, but I don't know the answer to that.
That's why I'm listening.
Mm-hmm. Right now, all the testing is, the testing from groups like Surf Rider is all enterococci, and there's been high levels. Is it misleading to say that if an area has high levels of that it's automatically contaminated? I mean, I heard the word enterococci contamination. I mean, I just don't want the public to be misled on, you know, just because it's high, it seems like you're tested and tested. There could be situations where it is high and it does show fecal and it would be dangerous, but I mean, I think it gets the public very confused on, you know, what is dirty water, what is clean water.
I really think that EPA, I mean, I really think it starts at the top, where the agency that has established these water quality criteria, essentially, and endorses using those tests, educate the public on what they mean. I mean, most people think you have high enterococcus, they think your enterococcus is the pathogen, or E. coli, and really there's a lot of misunderstanding about it, and it's confusing. I mean, it's unlike other contaminants that are measured, where, you know, if you're measuring high amounts of lead in a sample, that lead itself is the bad thing. In this case, it's not necessarily the indicator that's the pathogen. It's what it is potentially associated with. And hopefully what I at least conveyed to you is that there's a lot of research that shows that the enterococci can come from a lot of sources. And so unless you really know what those sources are, you don't know what the level of risk is. And so that's where, you know, as long as those indicators are what we're using to assess water quality, then you know, the people who say need to use those need to help the public understand what it is telling us and what they're not telling us.
I think we're really lucky because Ali Bame and her group came and studied streams on Oahu, and they were then able to correlate the entero and clostridia counts with staph and strep and vibrio and I don't even remember what else. So for Hawaii, we have this correlation in concentrations of real pathogens with our indicators here on streams on Oahu. So
yeah, I mean, there needs to be a lot of work done like that. And then, I mean, the gold standard, what I envision is that sometime in the future, when people decide they want to, you know, fund this type of work more than it's being funded now, we use modern methods of assessing water, you know, more modern methods. And the methods are getting better every day. I mean, we got these DNA-based methods. All this stuff's only going to get better in the future. And so hopefully, you know, maybe we can do tests where we have a panel of different pathogens that can be easily tested for. And the problem is that it can't really be easily tested for by labs that, frankly, operate on shoestring budgets. And so that's technology development. But in order for that to happen, there's going to, you know, need to be a lot more work done. These epidemiology studies, you know, in order to one of the reasons we're stuck with enterococcus is that, you know, it was the best available thing we had when a lot of these epidemiology studies were done to make those associations. I think there's definitely going to be better methods out there in the future, but it's hard to do those studies to really correlate them with the illness rates. Hopefully that can be done, and we won't be having, you know, all this uncertainty is really difficult, and it's really why there needs to be more education that comes with these numbers, so that the public understands what they are telling you or not, what needs to be done in order to really determine what the level of risk is. And I think there's a lot of discussion, a lot of thought about how to go about that, and hopefully that will be done in the near future.
And it's past 6 o'clock, and I know that you've endured this along with us, and so thank you very much for attending. And if you have further questions, certainly you have Eric's email address, but as well as any of us at DOH, our convention of email is firstname.lastname@doh.hawaii.gov. So my name is Janet Hashimoto. I'll be here for at least several months. And Alec Wong, the branch chief, Myron Honda, and of course Gary Wenton right here on the island. So we really appreciate you coming out here. And something that Carl last mentioned, you know, you mentioned Ali Bame study. That is actually the next step we'd like to do here. I mean, most of the stream samples that she did and associated with the actual pathogenic pathogens itself, we'd like to take this to the next step if you're, you know, we'd like to collaborate with the community as well, because we certainly won't want to continue to test here and you know, and not give something back that will be useful to this community. So but we think that this might be the next best place for us to launch into the quantitative microbial risk assessment and to really associate the pathogens that might be coming from these enterococci that we see here and see whether or not, how risky is it. And even if it may be into the 1,000, perhaps the risk is low. We don't know that. Allie Bain from Stanford, what she did for the Oahu streams was to look specifically for norovirus, campylobacter, and all these other types of actual pathogens, and said that even though we're getting high counts of both the enterococci and or the other potential fecal tracer, Clostridium, she found that based on how much of the pathogen she was finding, the risk is low. And believe it or not, it's not like QMRA is new to the world and the nation. It's been done and all over the place. But the reason why I think we can potentially break ground here is that this is the first place where we really think some of your high counts, and I won't say that that's true for a lot of places on Hawaii because you do have cesspools. It is something that we really need to advance and try to get rid of. But in areas where we don't see huge amounts of cesspools or wastewater treatment plants that are failing or septic systems that are failing, we may not really be giving you the right information about the real health risk. And the reason why I said that we may be breaking ground here is because in all the other places where QMRA has been done, they're always finding at least 10% of the sources are human. Since we're closer to zero, if not zero here, this might be the place where we might actually advance beyond what EPA has provided, which is enterococci. We proved to you here, I hope, that you understand that this is not necessarily the best indicator really that is associated with health risk in swimming waters. So just wanted to give you that possible next step that we'd like to kind of advance here. And this seems to be a good place to do it. I mean, we can certainly look for other places on Oahu because Allie Bain has already started that work for us. But since we thought this really indicated zero, you know, if you're willing to be part of our team, we'd like to come back and do additional tests and studies here.
Chance, I'd like to make one recommendation.
Okay.
That is, I heard the word collaboration.
Yes.
Educating the public. Could you possibly be more timely in the release of the information? It took me 2 years.
Eric, explain.
It wasn't explained sufficiently enough. When you say collaborate, and then the public has to go and file a FOIA, public records, that's not collaboration. Mm-hmm. That's playing ahead of the game. So I think you would be so well off, better off, if you were to work with the public and not engage in a chain of emails back and forth about grammar, and then when the final straw is broken, you say that, well, we're going to release it to you after we decide whether we have a press conference or do a news release after 2 years. So I think, in all respect, if you are going to collaborate with the public, then work timely with them. They're not okay. They're not going to run out there and spike the samples to get out unless as accused Watson or Kubo. This is why it's rather suspect, the whole thing, because
yes,
Watson was busy saying, well, these guys, the Mahalapu folks, want to shut down the dairy, so we don't want to jump to conclusions. Mm-hmm. And so that's not collaboration, that's okay. Manipulation. So I would encourage you to be successful, you too. And then I personally have questions like, how did you arrive at him in procurement practices? How did you arrive at him or this Davinsky? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful. But all of that comes into play. So when you use these terms, collaborate with others,
yeah.
Collaborate with them.
Yeah.
But
yes,
be equal. So then you'll probably have take no more aspirins or headaches, ibuprofen.
And full disclosure, the reason why we did the study, frankly, was when I was with EPA, I encouraged them to go through the next step of an actual microbial source tracking mechanism. Phylochip happened to be one of the new innovations that, of course, back in home, I'm in San Francisco, Erickson, Berkeley. You know, it's simple to reach out to colleagues that are right near your home, including Allie Bain, who's in Stanford. So, and then when I go back, even for a visit, I'm going to try to visit with Jeff Soler, who has advanced a whole bunch of papers on quantitative microbial risk assessment. So, yeah, some of the email exchanges, actually, if you had FOIA'd me at EPA, you would see my email saying, Eric, where's the study? You know, we've been waiting for it, so.
Because Carol was asking for it 2 years ago.
Yes, exactly, and then we did the same.
But you're out talking about it, but Carol is kept in the dark and is
right, right. Well, anyway, so.
Yeah, we regret that it takes so long. I mean, a lot of that was on us. And then there was time that, you know, the study does get submitted as a draft, and the people who are contracting us get an opportunity.
Well, you don't have to defend yourself.
No, I know, but
I'm an expert.
So, but I'm just saying that process takes time as well. And it's part of the reason why we want to take this out of a research lab, who's our main mission our research mission isn't just to do this. I mean, we do all sorts of other things, and this needs to, if it's going to be used regularly as a tool, it needs to go somewhere where it's done efficiently, and that's
The last thing you want to do is disrespect you or any of them.
It's no, just I don't that see it as disrespect, public, but it's a fair,
public
it's an
information
absolutely fair question.
And Dr. Berg and all the other folks here wanting to know, and the information is there, but it's not being timely, and now you're struggling to try and justify our
getting. Well, no, I mean, the problem was the information wasn't there because we hadn't generated it yet.
Okay.
And so it took a while to get it out. And that's tough on you guys because you want to know what's going on. I mean, that's understandable. This is your backyard. So
anyway, thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much for Dr. Erickson.
Thank you.